KBTC, a viewer-supported community service of Bates Technical College.
From KBTC Public Television Studios in Tacoma, Washington, welcome to the Steve on the Street podcast, a closer look behind the headlines as public policy and current affairs impact the real lives of real people.
Hello, and welcome to the Steve on the Street podcast, produced by KBTC Public Television's public affairs program, Northwest Now. I'm your host, photojournalist and reporter Steve Kiggins. Today's podcast covers the homelessness crisis in the Puget Sound region, a crisis ongoing for years and years. We're going to be talking with a community activist who offers mutual aid for those living without housing, and she is intimately connected with the population. And a not-so-newcomer to the scene, the folks who run the privately funded nonprofit We Heart Seattle, which is also no stranger to criticism. To call the issue of homelessness a crisis seems to be a bit of a stretch, as any other crisis we can imagine would not continue to perpetuate for such a long time. We're going to have to go back a number of years to set up how we find ourselves where we are today. Supplementing this podcast is reporting thanks to Cairo News Radio and Seattle Times, and my own memory covering the topic when I was then a TV reporter for one of the commercial TV stations here in Seattle. More than a decade ago, in the fall of 2015, both King County Executive Dow Constantine and Ed Murray, Mayor of Seattle, declared states of emergencies, where they compared the circumstances for those living unsheltered in our region as being one of devastation. Just a few months later, in an evening in January 2016, a report of a shooting sent Seattle police investigating, and they soon discovered victims inside an unsanctioned homeless camp on WashDOT property underneath Interstate 5. The homeless camp had a notorious name. It was called The Jungle. In total, five people have been shot. Two of them died. The shooting happened just as then-Mayor Ed Murray was preparing to give a televised speech discussing plans that the city would take to address the widespread homelessness in the city. Mayor Murray himself made his way to Soto, to the crime scene, where he said the jungle had been allowed to remain underneath and around the freeway for decades. He said at the time, quote, "We are involved in a homelessness crisis like that we have not seen since the Great Depression. There is no simple answer," he said. Now, solutions have come and gone. After Seattle Mayor Ed Murray resigned in September 2017, his administration and then interim mayor Tim Burgess continued to work on what was called the Navigation Team that launched in February 2017. The Navigation Team included sending caseworkers alongside police officers into homeless camps to assess their needs and help move individuals out of the camps and into shelters. The team included an SPD sergeant and specially trained officers that were paired with outreach and field coordinators and providers. And during its time, there were 25 people part of the team, 13 SPD officers. That's according to reporting from Seattle Times. Then in 2020, during the COVID-19 pandemic, then Seattle City Council voted to defund the Navigation Team. At the time, Seattle's Mayor Jenny Durkin vetoed their vote, but ultimately, City Council voted to override the mayor's veto. In its time, the team removed more than 1,200 encampments, and according to Seattle Times, they were camps that posed the most health and safety concerns. Besides the Navigation Team, the City of Seattle also funded multiple organizations simultaneously, organizations that worked with various homeless populations. Today, the work and spending by the City of Seattle continues with a multi-pronged approach to bring people indoors, create places to live, and help in new ways. Now, Seattle Mayor Bruce Harrell's One Seattle Homelessness Action Plan touts its success, saying it's referred more than 500 people to indoor shelter and outreach in the first quarter of 2024. The city has budgeted in 2024 more than $165 million to tackle homelessness, with much of that funding going to the King County Regional Homelessness Authority. The authority is its own independent public body and was formed in late 2019 to unite Seattle, King County, and ultimately nearly 40 other regional cities under one plan to tackle homelessness. It's funded by the City of Seattle, the federal government, King County, and the state in that order, according to Seattle Times reporting. KCRHA awards contracts to nonprofits to provide homeless services and more. The agency's first ever CEO, Mark Doans, however, did not last long. He resigned in June 2023, citing burnout and, according to Seattle Times, Doan said county taxpayers and officials are, quote, too busy pointing fingers for the crisis instead of acknowledging that it is the result of a 100-year failure of the county's housing policy. Plus, the agency's initial five-year draft plan announced in January 2023, the estimated cost to end homelessness could cost billions of dollars over the next 5 years. So why so high? In 2022, the agency said it wouldn't use that year's federally mandated point-in-time count to base its draft. In 2020, the count estimated King County's homeless population grew 5%, finding nearly 12,000 people were living without shelter on one singular night in January. Doan said, however, that number is inaccurate, and adding that the agency would instead use a different data set from King County, which tracks every person who's homeless that accesses services like shelter, behavioral, and medical health throughout the entire year. The authority revealed their data shows more than 48,000 people were living without homes at the time. According to the Seattle Times, Doan said at his departure from the authority, quote, "We keep having the conversation at the absolute wrong scale." Subsequent to Doan's departure, the authority released, voted on, and approved a new five-year plan, citing a new estimate that shows more than 53,000 people are living without homes, and adding it would cost $11.2 billion over the next 5 years to address the problem. This has obviously received pushback from many, including elected leadership. And the agency is again restarting a search for a new CEO as the interim CEO, Darrell Powell, removed himself as a candidate just this week, according to Seattle Times. In a letter, Powell said, quote, "The Housing Authority is not in a position to serve the region's homeless population." Okay, that is a long explainer, but key, in my estimation, to understanding how we got to where we are and why there seems to be so much frustration about the growing population around our region. And if you've not heard of We Heart Seattle, or you're new to the area, take a listen to Northwest Now's coverage, where I was invited to witness the organization's efforts west of Capitol Hill in Seattle. Volunteers gather for a quick photo and a short break from pulling debris from Seattle's St. Mark's Greenbelt along Lakeview Boulevard in early May.
We bought all of these supplies from Home Depot. These are all volunteers.
We Heart Seattle's executive director, Andrea Suarez, keeps a nimble step on a steep trail leading where a camp found shelter for who knows how long.
This is garbage. There's nothing humane about moldy, rodent-infested, human feces-infested, dirty beds.
This is just one of more than 300 cleanups under the organization's belt. We Heart Seattle operates outside of the King County Regional Homelessness Authority and the City of Seattle's response to the crisis. Suarez says avoiding that bureaucracy allows her group to house neighbors more quickly, a point she hopes resonates when volunteers and others cast their vote.
We need you to come outside, see what's working and what's not, so we can be better informed when it comes to the ballot box.
More accurately describes them as a private encampment removal group.
Alicia Ramirez is a community organizer and shares close relationships with people living unhoused. She criticizes some of We Heart Seattle's tactics during outreach and handling an individual's property, among other complaints, but she says there's still enough blame to share.
And it's not strictly just We Heart Seattle. The city as well, for a long time, hasn't addressed the issue. And part of that just seems a lack of political will.
The number of those living on the street and public dollars spent to help have both grown over the years. Suarez champions We Heart Seattle's progress, saying it spent barely $600,000 in 2023. Seattle Mayor Bruce Harrell's One Seattle Homelessness Action Plan budgets more than $160 million for 2024 alone.
Nothing seems to make a significant dent.
Well, I'll tell you what's making a significant dent is private-funded organizations like We Heart Seattle that are taking action to clean our city, help the homeless.
Housing affordability, addiction, and many other factors intertwine the homelessness crisis. Ramirez adds, talking candidly with and about those facing the crisis headlong must begin conversations for reform.
We have to push our leaders, but the other part of that is we also have to change ourselves and our community, how we're talking and viewing about these folks, because otherwise you can't do one without the other.
In Seattle, Steve Kiggins, Northwest Now. Andrea Suarez is enthusiastic and committed to her work. and in other media interviews, complains of what's called the homeless industrial complex, alluding that instead of helping, it enables those continuing to live on the streets. Now, an extended interview with Andrea Suarez.
Direct action, like, you guys don't have the city here, the cops aren't here?
No cops, no city-supplied equipment. We bought all of these supplies from Home Depot. These are all volunteers, some people who have recently exited homelessness, which is a part of our program. Some people do protesting and riots and shut down bridges and blow up cop cars because they've got their beef. My beef is environmental and a humanitarian crisis that is sitting here, right here in the city of Seattle, untouched for years, if not decades in some cases. It's like an archaeological dig.
300 and some pics. You've seen realities most people can't even dream.
Needles, dead bodies, sharps. We've picked up over 35,000 needles. And anybody that wants to challenge me that this is not a drug addiction issue, crisis facing our city, our data is empiricism. It is observing what is actually going on at face value with our own eyes and ears and nose and smells and feet.
Nothing seems to make a significant dent.
Well, I'll tell you what's making a significant dent is private funded organizations like We Heart Seattle that are taking action to clean our city, help the homeless, take people to treatment, and get hands on with the crisis. You can't understand it because it is confusing out there. And I think of myself as a private funded navigation team because that was such an important team to have that kept people engaged with city social services. When we just leave them where they're at, we leave them there to die. We have 4 people a day dying in King County that we know of related to drug addiction, related to overdose. Our low barrier housing projects that we are in and out of on a regular basis are seeing people pass away at a higher rate than people that are outdoors right now. We need to shelter first, clean up the damn city, clean up the city, and then we can think, how many homeless do we have? You know, is every tent a home? When we started doing the cleanups, we were learning that, oh, that's the garbage tent, that's the toilet tent, that's the, you know, sex trafficking tent. And it was like one guy that was running a whole ecosystem known as the kingpin, known as a dealer. And so when we got up close and personal with it, we started to pull back the curtain and say, we don't even know what the hell's going on. Bad data equals bad law. And so in order to get ahead of that, my means to my end is now I am working with city council. Now I am working with law enforcement and other social providers that are like, you guys have the empirical data. We're here.
Does it look like to you the public policy is a matter of failure? And are you the solution? Or is there really any solution to the size of this issue?
Incrementally, we need to stand up sanction camps, shelter first, give people a place to go, enhance that so that we can see what the problem is who. And so volunteering and grassroots movement throughout history are what move society in a more positive direction, not revolutions, not the far left over here trying to dismantle society as we know it because this is systemic poverty or systemic racism, okay? We're just going after what's in front of us right now, which is trash and people down and out that need a hand up. So the solution is, you know, enforce the law. You can't be a drug dealer in the city of Seattle. And Mayor Harrell just stood up a emphasis team in downtown, and we're gonna start arresting people for misdemeanors again and possession of drugs, because every person that I know that's in recovery said it came down to being arrested and taking away my civil liberties because I was affecting the civil liberties of everyday citizens not being able to use their parks, use their sidewalks. And that is part of this movement, is to educate and wake people up that because we've elected a moderate council, for example, and a mayor and a city attorney that's taking action, we believe we were, you know, rooted in that and galvanized by the pandemic. That is the silver lining of the pandemic, is that Seattle is getting better.
Just one final question. Thank you for your patience and your flexibility. Was there a shift for you in terms of housing first policy?
Absolutely.
When did that occur and how did that develop?
It happened because my outreach staff here, we inevitably interact with the homeless, inevitably. And so we started learning about where we could refer people to. And so we housed people over and over and over again, and they would be right back out on the streets. We would go indoors to the low barrier villages and hotels and apartments to find that there were foils everywhere. There was human feces everywhere. There was dead bodies everywhere. My friend here, Michelle, she couldn't even get into her house anymore because it was cockroach infested. Her appliances didn't work. Her bed was full of black mold. And these are the organizations that have $50 to $100 million budgets. And that's when we stopped even trying to house anybody. And I'm screaming, it's a housing and housing contingent. Break up the open air use of drugs. Drugs are bad. Stigmatize drug use. Drugs are not welcome in Seattle. The mayor needs to make a very strong message that your drug use is killing my friend. Those dealers need to be arrested, in my opinion, for manslaughter.
That's kind of a U-turn.
It's like, what I didn't know that picking up all this trash was going to make me this like subject matter expert, because I sit on a lot of panels and I have a lot to say, and it's not in theory, it's not in academic, it's not because I went to UW, it's because my boots on the ground, our educators, our 13,000 hours of volunteers that logged and clocked time on the slope that said, what in the hell is going on? And by the way, people live right here in the slopes and have housing.
Suarez is a force to be sure. She's also filed to run to fill State Representative Frank Chopp's long-held seat in the state's 43rd Legislative District. Suarez is expected to face Sean Scott, a former candidate for Seattle Council. Now, We Heart Seattle has been in operation just over 3 years, forming in late 2020. Suarez said she began walking her neighborhood and decided she had to do something after seeing needles and people living homeless just about everywhere. The nonprofit group says it has since moved more than 200 people out of camps and into housing. They removed tens of thousands of needles from parks and green spaces and removed more than 1 million pounds of trash. And they've invited more than 1,000 volunteers to log 12,000 plus hours of their free time cleaning shared spaces in our city. But We Heart Seattle has also gathered plenty of criticism, cataloged on an anonymous website called We Heart Seattle Exposed. The page describes We Heart Seattle being disrespectful in removing tents and property and trashing some in the process. It makes claims the group does not include qualified case managers or social workers, and it claims We Heart Seattle's former executive director has since been charged with identity theft, allegations he took advantage of the very people he was supposed to be helping during his time employed by a city in Oregon after he left We Heart Seattle. To be clear, Suarez insists there's no connection, that the allegations in Oregon have any connection locally. According to reporting from Cairo News Radio, Suarez says We Heart Seattle is, quote, heartbroken for anyone harmed, and whatever hot water he is in has absolutely nothing to do with us and are blindsided by the news. And Suarez insists she is a caseworker, and when asked if she had licensing to conduct casework from Washington State or elsewhere, Suarez replied, quote, I don't know, did Jesus Christ have a license? Community activist Alicia Ramirez is not only intimately familiar with people who are living on the streets, she's also well-versed in the criticism laid against We Heart Seattle. Up next on the podcast, an extended interview with Alicia Ramirez.
A lot of my friends as a teenager were homeless youths, and as a young adult for the ages of about 18 to 20, I spent some time often with those friends at the Ryan Youth Day Center. It's the big green building on Denny Way. And so that's kind of originally how I'm familiar with the unhoused population, is just a lot of my friends were, or at some point, were homeless. So that's how I began. And then as a little bit of an older adult, I got involved in activism, learned how to do outreach, and then I got involved in that capacity.
Well, then, through that time and through those years, how did your interactions then start to include We Heart Seattle? Was it just with the volunteers? Was it with the founder, or was it with both of those things?
Initially, when they first popped up around 2020, they were called I Heart Downtown Seattle, I think. Mm-hmm. I hadn't had much interaction with them at that point, but I did see them doing their cleanups. And what was concerning to me and some other folks that, you know, worked with unsheltered folks is that these cleanups were getting very close to folks' tent. I know like the city has like a 20 or 30 foot rule kind of for a reason. And we're looking at that and a little bit concerned. And what really had me concerned was around the fall, there was a group of community members that were volunteering cooking burgers at Miller Park for some unsheltered folks, and they had had a very concerning interaction with Andrea, their founder, where she had tried to convince them to make the folks at the camp work for the food, and when they refused, she went to the folks and told them that they had to work for the hamburgers. It was at that point that there was a lot of concern about, you know, the tactics that she was using. And when those concerns were brought forward, neither her or her organization reacted very well to those concerns or addressed them. And since then, they've kind of just grown and grown and grown as far as the number of concerns and the intensity and everything else regarding some of our unsheltered neighbors.
This is kind of a snapshot of one, like, anecdotal experience.
Yeah.
What about kind of from a top level view about what you've seen and what you've heard, I guess, in a concise way, how would you describe, is it more of their tactics these days, or is it something like they don't have the trained, like, experience to be doing what they're doing or offering services that they claim that they are?
It's kind of all of the above. Like, anyone can go out and do offer help or you know, offer food or community resources, but that's a different thing than saying that you are a caseworker, and that comes with its own set of, you know, trainings and kind of regulations around it, and it kind of has a certain different level of authority. As someone who had a caseworker at one point in my life, I understand the difference. And what it means to get really bad advice could really be detrimental for you. The other concerns that we've had is just, or that I've heard, or that, you know, it's been, you know, kind of repeated over the years, is, you know, going in to a camp that's occupied and then throwing away folks' belongings, for instance, or, you know, going into a tent where someone, they may not be there, and then just throwing away all the belongings as garbage. And things like that may not sound like a big deal, but if you are living unsheltered, you know, that might be all of your personal documents have been thrown away. And that's, even with city sweeps, that commonly happens. And then what we're also concerned about, as I'm sure you've probably heard, their former president is facing a lot of prison charges, and that is also concerning because at one point he was that group's mentor. I've looked into their 990 reports, and they paid him for consulting services. So if this is who you're consulting with, that's very concerning for how you're interacting with the community. And there's just been a lot of stories about, you know, folks being offered, you know, a placement for housing or, you know, detox, and then the group not following through, or offering, you know, to store some of their belongings and not follow through. Like, just a lot of those is just boils down to just a lack of accountability. I know that, you know, actual social services are overwhelmed, but if a social worker goes out and they cause harm, there's at least a way to hold them accountable to the community. And with groups like We Heart Seattle, that doesn't really exist. We don't really have a mechanism to hold them accountable. And there hasn't really been a conversation of, well, what does that accountability look like? How do we hold them accountable? And I think that's important, but unfortunately, there's a lot of people that don't view unsheltered people as people and are completely fine with all these accusations being true. And I think that's kind of how they've gotten away with, you know, doing some of these actions for so long. It's just because people view that population as less than. And if there was another population, like say a population of children, or if it was abused women, they wouldn't have been able to get this far. So I think the accountability piece is really important. And it's also important to, you know, deal with the root causes of why people are living on the street, which is one of them is lack of affordable housing. We don't even have enough beds for detox for folks who want to go, which is frustrating, because to hear We Heart Seattle say that there's tons of these beds available kind of just minimizes the reality of there isn't.
Beyond kind of the optics in terms of what they publish and broadcast in terms of like social media presence, do you think there's, are they really here to do this to clean neighborhoods, or is this a means to some other end?
I think really what more accurately describes them is a private encampment removal group, and that's basically how they operate. And if you look at it in that sense, then I think, you know, basically it's, you know, contracts, funding, things like that. I can't look into Andrea's heart and know what exactly she's thinking and feeling, but just based on her actions and her words of just her and her organization, it just seems like the reasons that they're doing this are self-serving and not really for the benefit of the community. Andrea Suarez did file to run against Sean Scott. So I think there is some political motivator behind it.
Do you think your claims about humanitarian and environmental efforts is truly genuine?
I think, you know, she might really care. She might truly care about the environment to a point, but part of that is also realizing that things like, you know, the climate emergency we're dealing with are often impacted upon folks that are extremely poor the most. And framing it in a way that makes it sound as if those folks are a cause of it is really counterproductive when it comes to, you know, solving that along with the housing crisis. And I know folks have tried to point this out to her, and it's been a little, she's been really reticent to hear it. But there is a climate emergency, but unfortunately that climate emergency is going to impact the folks living on the street and the poorest among us the most. And I think there's ways to address that that will also really benefit them in ways that aren't also demonizing them in this bigger, you know, context of both homelessness and then the climate disaster we're both dealing with at the same time.
I want to hit rewind it and talk to you just a little bit more about what you know about their interactions when they're speaking with these populations. Compared to folks versed in the industry, versed in that kind of world, do you think they're capable of identifying, like, what reality really looks like? Like, is this really a disgusting disaster, or is this, right, or is this someone's home, and, like, is this, like, is it just a little, you know, messed up? I mean, do you understand what I'm asking?
Yeah, I understand what, basically, you're asking what, if they can distinguish between what's garbage and what's actually not garbage when they go into the encampment.
If you're not used to seeing those things, but for the tent on the side of the road as you drive home from work, that's all you know.
Right. I think anyone's possible learning and change when it comes to learning about these kinds of things and, you know, treating people that are living with absolutely nothing with, you know, all the respect that you can. But I think Andrea and certain people in her organization have been really unwilling to kind of learn these lessons. I know that there's been multiple community members who have tried to sit down with her and have a discussion about, you know, these things aren't garbage and here's why, and she's been really unwilling to hear that. So I think it's possible for them to change their tactics, but not with the leadership they currently have.
Considering they've raised, you know, $750,000, they now, as far as I understand, this coming weekend they'll be working on the One Seattle Day of Service, and they've got the ear of council majority.
Yes, and some of the council, I know multiple members of the council, like Kathy Moore, has been a volunteer with We Heart Seattle at least a couple of times during her campaign. I think Bob Saka as well. So the council has shifted, and she definitely has, or the organization now has a much more friendly ear. It'll be interesting to see what she does with that.
That question then is, if the kind of perception is short of tacit approval, does this now become a model for other organizations to repeat these things? When they watch King County Homelessness Regional Authority and the City of Seattle spend $160 million this year?
I think that's already kind of happened over the course of a couple of years.
Yeah.
They had We Heart Portland for a little while. That fizzled out. I know there's been some other iHeart local groups that have kind of popped in and out of existence. The More We Love is set up very similarly. So I think that's already there. And unfortunately, it's going to continue to be there. And even if We Heart Seattle doesn't exist in 5 years, there will be another We Heart Seattle until and unless we address the crisis and we address the affordable housing crisis and we, you know, address the rising cost of rents, and we address the fact that we don't have enough mental health facilities for folks who want them and enough detox facilities that want them. Because otherwise there will always be bad actors that will kind of take advantage of that.
Do you view any of the work that We Heart Seattle does in a positive light?
I think it's kind of unfortunate almost, because I think had the group not gone on the route they had gone, it could have been a really beneficial and positive group that could have gotten, you know, people in the city involved in helping in a positive way. So I think it's, anything's possible, but I think for them to have a possibility to go that route, they would have to do some real overhaul in their organization, if their organizational structure.
Part of her reaction to do this is the city's spent over, you know, a long number of years, an enormous amount of money that appears to not make a significant indentation in the sizable and growing number of folks that are homeless. So can you lay blame on We Heart Seattle's tactics and the city? Like, is anybody doing enough?
Oh, I think the city also has blame in this, because the city, and not just Seattle, King County, a lot of localities could and should have been doing more, because we knew that this was coming, and we haven't even seen the worst of it yet. We haven't even fell off that cliff. So I think there's a lot of blame here, and it's not strictly just We Heart Seattle. The city as well, for a long time, hasn't addressed the issue. And part of that just seems a lack of political will. You know, we need housing, we need especially low-income housing, we need all these services, but we have to build them somewhere. And to build them somewhere, you're going to get pushback. But, you know, part of being a strong leader is doing really hard things in tough times. And unfortunately, that lack of leadership doesn't lead to, you know, good things.
So clearly, this is a complicated issue. Homelessness in and around Seattle and our region is hard to miss, and those living in tents are often not in places that are safe. Yet, the cost to continue helping combat the problem continues to rise year after year. A solution, one everyone can agree to, it's hard to nail down. Addiction also plays a major role in all of this, leading to the question, which crisis is worse?
and which should take precedent as a matter of public health and public policy. Not to mention there are cases where people, for whatever reason, claim they prefer to live where they are. If that's in a tent, in a green belt, behind your neighborhood, or along a public right-of-way, that reality exists. But what is clear, it's just too hard to imagine any young person, one with a full life of opportunity within their immediate future, could come to the conclusion of, gosh, I sure hope one day to be living in squalor inside a cold and wet tent outdoors next to speeding traffic. Perhaps even if we are frustrated at the cost required to manage this issue, maybe a better question might be, do we want to pay for this now, or do we want to pay for this later? What's the difference? What is the cost required to convince a single person out of their tent now, compared to what it costs to continue sending services in and out of their lives, sending medical services in and out of their lives, in and out of the hospital, where eventually they rot out of sight, their struggle ignored and unseen? How much does that scenario, laden with neglect, cost all of us? I hope this podcast got you thinking, and I appreciate your continued support by listening. So, thanks to Alicia Ramirez for your bravery, sharing your views, and also thanks to Andrea Suarez from We Heart Seattle for sharing your time on the broadcast. And finally, thank you. Thank you for taking the interest and time to listen to an obviously long version of the Steve on the Street podcast. It's always nice that you share the effort to stay connected here. Once again, I'm your host, photojournalist and reporter Steve Kiggins from Northwest Now. Cheers.